is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud.
This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny. It will decide whether we rapidly create millions of high-paying jobs or whether we crush our industries and send millions of these jobs overseas, as has foolishly been done for many decades. Your vote will decide whether we protect law-abiding Americans or whether we give free rein to violent anarchists and agitators and criminals who threaten our citizens. And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it.
Well, it's either going to be Donald Trump's America or Joe Biden's America. That's what we're hearing at this point. And that is the really big talking point here on Viewpoint this week, my fellow Americans. And lots to talk about today. Lots in the news here. You're seeing, again, the unrest in the cities. You're seeing attacks on just citizens that are, you know, in restaurants, walking to cars. You're seeing all kinds of things play out in the Republic here. Then a lot of other things. You hear about the nationwide sports shutdown. We've never seen anything like this, and that all plays to the same conversation. I'd like to start at the top of the program here and welcome on Tony Schaefer. Tony is a retired CIA-trained senior intelligence operative and president of the London Center for Policy Research. Well, you hear the president there, save the American dream or a socialist agenda. Whether we create millions of jobs or crush our industries by sending jobs overseas, as we've done for decades. And of course, most Americans know that. He says your vote will decide if we protect law-abiding Americans or give free rein to violent anarchists, agitators, and criminals who threaten our citizens. In just those few seconds, that one talking point, the president said a great deal. How do you size up the two conventions and the president's speech?
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be on, and this is a great topic. I've actually watched with probably like you, great interest, both conventions, not only from the policy perspective, but just the way the American people viewed what it looked like. And I think the introduction piece you used really does summarize very nicely what the difference was between the two conferences, the two conventions. The Democrat convention, frankly, it looked like a high school audiovisual department just kind of threw it all together, and the production values were horrible. President Trump, on the other hand, as he said in his opening, has focused on this first 4 years in trying to help establish business opportunities for everyone. This includes investment communities, incubators, if you will, in all the different cities for minorities to take advantage of, as well as defending against foreign interests our economy. We recognized during the pandemic, for example, China. We depended far too much on China for any number of things, everything from pharmaceuticals to PPE.
But a lot of that's going to change now as well. I mean, I think that's one thing the pandemic has done, right? It's going to change that.
Absolutely. So as a matter of fact, you and I should probably talk about that, the supply chain issue. Mm-hmm. The think tank I run, the London Center, is actually partnering with Rutgers University Business School on this very issue. So yes, the answer is the whole issue of China and economy is going to be looked at as a bipartisan issue. Again, Rutgers is not a conservative institution, but they're very interested and working on this for the business community of how do we fix this. But getting back to the issue regarding the two conventions, President Trump has examined the economy from the perspective of how do we benefit American workers, American consumers, and the American dream from the perspective of protecting it and expanding it. And this is in stark contrast to the Democrats. So Joe Biden did not once call out the issues as they relate to China or foreign markets or the potential damage that can become to that. And the other thing, obviously, Joe Biden did not talk about is that multiple administrations, to include both his administration and the Bush administration to a certain extent, saw the export of good-paying jobs to foreign markets. Let's face it, it's cheaper to produce things in China and Mexico than it is here. Right. And that has hurt badly the blue-collar workers of the nation. And I think President Trump has reversed that. As a matter of fact, one of the key states in the key swing states right now is Pennsylvania. And I think Pennsylvania is far better under President Trump because of Trump's interest in the U.S. economy and the U.S. worker. And Joe Biden, for you know, supposedly being from Scranton, Joe from Scranton, has done very little for that. So
yeah,
if you examine just those content points of the two conventions, you'll see that I think President Trump did a far better, more persuasive job of selling the American public on what he's done and what he will do versus the Democrats.
Well, Tony, your point about, and I'm glad you brought up the whole China point, and that's one of the biggest issues, but you're right when you say the DNC and the Biden convention didn't go there, but quite frankly, they didn't go anywhere. Their major motivation was just Trump is bad. You know, as they say, orange man bad, they say, right? Yeah. And that's their talking point. So they really didn't address the unrest. They didn't address what, in fact, you would think they were talking about another country at some point. They weren't even talking about America, huh?
Right. So the unrest is a very interesting point because I live in Northern Virginia. The think tank I run is actually in Manhattan. And what's funny is that I won't go to either place right now because of because of the chaos. I mean, look, we often would hold in-person events in Manhattan because the London Center for Policy Research is based in Manhattan. So I'm up there. I was up there often. It's unsafe. The Bill de Blasio has made the city unlivable. And the same in D.C. Muriel Bowser has actually done things to support Black Lives Matter to the point of where she's encouraged these Marxists to be so active they will literally go out and harass private citizens while they're going about living their lives. So in my judgment, and these are Democrat controlled strongholds.
Which is what the president points out. But you know, you speak about Muriel Bowser there a moment. That's a perfect case. And what's happening is it seems like the mayors there of a lot of these Democrat markets, these Democrat cities, it's like they're asking law enforcement to stand down.
Right.
A perfect case when people were leaving the White House, a lot of dignitaries, politicians, but also just regular people. They were assaulted and confronted with the mob. And the mob, right, meaning that's a combination of the it's all domestic terrorism, but that's a combination of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's a combination of the Antifa fascists there. It's all of that criminal component that's there. And they're getting out of hand, going into restaurants, forcing people to put the fisk up. They're doing other things. Where do you think all that's going? I mean, it's getting pretty serious.
Well, this is the danger of Marxism. To be blunt with you, I mean, the idea here is compliance. I have a degree in political science. I graduated in 1986 from Rice State University in Dayton, Ohio. I've studied comparative political systems, and ultimately, one only has to look at the Soviet system. And I would encourage people to do their own independent research on Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin. And while there was a lot of literally sub-branded, you know, concepts within the Russian Soviet system, it ultimately was all about control, and that control included how you thought, how you acted, and how information was used.
Tony, is that what we got going on right now in America? What you just laid out, is that it?
That's it. And this is the beginning of it. And so the whole idea was, and I encourage people, I produce TV, but I did not have anything to do with the HBO series Chernobyl. But anybody who looks at Chernobyl and looks at how the truth was negotiable, remember that. The truth is negotiable based on what it needs to be to support the party. And that's what we're seeing here in the United States. The Democrats are trying to essentially, with their cohorts in the media, establish control of truth. Mm-hmm. And it is the truth that they deem it to be rather than what it is factually. It's very dangerous. It's very Orwellian. And I often tweet about newspeak. And that's what we're seeing here is the idea. Right. It's not, they will not argue with you or debate with you using objective truth. They have to demean you. They have to undermine your credibility for purposes of trying to make you irrelevant, no matter how factual what you're saying is.
Yeah, Tony, that is so well said. Now, this incident right now in the past many days with Rand Paul, let's talk about that a moment here. And there's a whole series of these videos floating out there, but Rand Paul has been one of the most vocal, and certainly because he's got the platform and the soapbox to be able to do that as a sit-in senator, you know. Right. So he says he was in fear. He was feared of being killed. He and his wife both spoke out very, very bravely about it with their clash with the activists here. You have a tweet up, which I thought was quite fascinating. You're never one short of words, which is why I enjoy really your thoughts here. You say here, yes, at Joe Biden, and all the violence by your supporters, Antifa in is yours, BLM is yours, Richard Spencer is yours, all hate and division is yours. And the next line, I think you'll get a prize for. If Satan was going to join a political party, well, he would join the Democrats and vote for you. Now, that's a hell of a tweet here. Comment on that and Senator Rand Paul, please, and what happened up there in D.C.
Yeah, so I know Senator Paul. We are friendly. We talk. On a variety of issues, and I can't imagine a more pacifist senator for these guys to go after. Rand Paul, as you know, his father Ron Paul was very anti-war, and so I don't think Rand's very libertarian. He spoke out against war. He's very peaceful, and for these guys to go after the most peaceful senator I know is completely insane and unhinged. And yes, these people were attempting to physically intimidate the senator during the post convention walk away from the White House. And it's very apparent that these people have no interest in listening to the other side, having dialogue. It's all about physical and psychological intimidation, which is very dangerous.
Yeah, ironically, let me jump in. Ironically, with Rand Paul now, he said that they were shouting, no justice, no peace, and say her name. And this was kind of fascinating because they were speaking about Breonna Taylor, who was the 26-year-old up in Louisville that had that no-knock warrant. But what's really fascinating about this is, and Rand Paul comes out and talks about this later, he says, let me read his quote here. He said, they were trying to push the police over to get me. They were grabbing at us, and it got worse and worse and worse. And finally, we decided to make a move. They were shouting threats to us, to kill us, to hurt us, but also threats saying, you know, say her name. You couldn't reason with this, he said, but I'm actually the author of the Taylor Law to end no-knock raids. So the irony is lost on these idiots, he says. This is what the senator says now. What do you think of that?
I agree. No, I'm against the no-knock raids, too. This is something I share. We're actually, we'll be announcing, you guys kind of get the heads up on it here. We'll be announcing this coming week the establishment of an accountability center. Bernie Kerik, former police commissioner of New York, is joining us. We'll be making the public announcement of it this coming week. And one of our topics is police accountability. Look, as much as I am pro-police, I'm a member of law enforcement here in Virginia. I advise Sheriff Dave Decatur in Stafford County. I'm his Homeland Security Advisor, so I am actually credentialed to work as a member of law enforcement here. I am the first to say law enforcement must be held accountable, and no-knock warrants are very dangerous, as we've seen from that event. So I'm with Senator Paul on this. And yeah, I think the grand irony of the very man who is working to help reform police is accosted by these Black Lives Matter folks who really, as I mentioned earlier, don't really care about the objective truth. It's all about power. It's all about controlling the message. And even if someone's on your side, it just doesn't matter. They're going to come after you, and that's what's very dangerous.
Now, mayors like Muriel Bowser, are they asking the police to stand? And there was no really very limited police presence right up there. There seems to be part of a strategy here with these Democrat cities where they don't seem to be, well, they're not talking out against it, number one. Right. They're not taking steps to prevent it, number two. And number three is they're not protecting the citizens. And that seems to be on display here with a lot of these people that were leaving these public events. The law enforcement was nowhere really to be found in any great numbers, you see.
And I find that significant and ironic, because the whole idea here is that you would want people like Rand Paul to be your friend, to be your ally. And this is very difficult because, and for me and others who understand that this is a policy choice. These political leaders, Ted Wheeler in Philadelphia and Portland, the I can't remember her name, the mayor of Seattle, the leadership in Minneapolis, de Blasio in New York, these are all choices they're making to not support. Let me be very clear. They are not supporting the everyday citizens, and they have sided with the mob, with Black Lives Matter, with Antifa, for purposes of allowing people, citizens, to be intimidated, businesses to be burned. And it's very dangerous. And let me speak out for a second on just New York. De Blasio has done tremendous damage, as we all know, by this no bail, essentially, you know, for any number of crimes, which has led to more crime. And he has defunded the police. Now, I've heard Ocasio-Cortez say, oh, well, that's next year. It's like, no. What has happened that people aren't talking about in great detail is that De Blasio cut all overtime by the NYPD. That is to say that that the NYPD was most effective because they had officers who were putting in 60 to 80 hours a week, maximizing their coverage. It's gone. And that's how and why the police aren't there anymore, is because while they have a great force, you can only be there as long as you're authorized to be there. So that's what we're seeing, is these little policy decisions behind the scenes by these Democrat progressive mayors, which hobble the law enforcement of their own city to respond. And that's why you see in D.C. and all these other cities an abandoning of the common values of protecting individual citizens.
It's a good way to put it. Common values. Yeah, good way to put it. Now, what do you think about it? Is any of this about race? Is any of this about race?
No, it's not. I find it grandly ironic that many of the so-called BLM protesters are yelling at Black law enforcement officers, telling, you know, basically calling them sellouts. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think you recognize this as well as I do. Most of the departments in most of these major metropolitan cities are run by Black individuals. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how, in cases where the police departments are run by Black officers, this could be anything regarding Black Lives Matter. It's simply insane.
But isn't that the way the far left always operate? Yes. Whatever they're promoting and putting out there is exactly the opposite.
Right.
Yeah. So this plays to that narrative. Yeah. Let's talk about the nationwide sports shutdown. This is a real eye opener. And you put a great tweet out about this as well, which it certainly spoke to me. And you said, I'm done with all professional sports. I will not attend or watch. This is pure propaganda and virtue signaling. If they were serious, they would contribute their salaries and bonuses for the causes they now say are so important, all phonies. So you spoke out pretty strongly about it. Now, this story was unbelievable. Now, I don't know if this is the end of professional sports in America or if this is just the beginning of something else. I don't know. But we're talking athletes in the NBA, the WNBA, the MLS, the MLB. This is right across the board here. I think the only one that didn't get involved, the last I knew, was hockey, but that might have changed as well. And this started with the Milwaukee Bucks walking off and the basketball. And, of course, basketball is under a lot of they're having a lot of troubles in there with basketball. LeBron James has been at the head of all of this. What do you make of this, Tony? And, I mean, I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah. Well, let me hit three points at once on this. First, to finish off the thought about the differences in conventions, the Democrat convention seemed to kowtow to Hollywood and to high-level folks. the Republican convention really focused on everyday individuals. And President Trump had a number of folks speak out during the convention over that time who are just like you and me. They're trying to live their lives. And this is another, the NBA and all these other folks shows to the bubble that the progressive liberal world live in. They don't live in our world. And so when they start doing this virtual signal thing, it just shows us that they're out of touch to the point of where it's they don't need our money. And let's remember here that these people are highly paid professionals who get a lot of money to go out and do play sports. And not a single one of them are willing to put their money where their mouth is. This includes the Obamas. President Obama spoke out in support of this whole thing. Last time I checked, he's living in multi-million dollar residence in Martha's Vineyard here in D.C. And making big bucks, cashing big checks like these athletes. And yet they're the last ones to actually do anything to help. Let's talk about this for a second. What if these athletes and Obama got some money together, put together a foundation to actually go in and do investment in communities within Chicago, within Minneapolis, to actually find a way to counter the culture of violence which exists in these cities? Mm-hmm. That, to me, is showing that Black lives matter. Anything less than that is virtue signaling. And that's what it is. All this is this, oh, we're not going to play today because we want to show such.
But Tony, who does this hurt, really? I mean, they're the ones who get paid the money for doing the game, the job, right, or the game. I mean, who the hell are they hurting? It's got to be themselves.
Ultimately hurt themselves because, you know, there's the saying out there, which I tend to believe, you go woke, go broke.
Right.
I don't think I'm the only one who feels this way. It's like, you know, if I watch a game, I've gone to Washington National games, I'm there to watch baseball. I'm not there to be preached at.
Exactly.
And if I'm paying money to watch someone perform, it's not, you know, I'm not paying to be preached at politically.
There, I could talk to you for, many, many hours, and we will just ahead, Tony. A big thank you here to Tony Schaefer to get us started in the program on the top stories here. All right, so let me tell you what we're going to do next here. We're going to get into some of these important issues in the 2020 election. Michael Johns will join us on crime, on the economy, on COVID. A little bit later in the program, we've got a very interesting segment with some law enforcement leaders that'll be here talking about this Jacob Blake case in Wisconsin, and also these rioters that are really getting out of hand that we're seeing, that we're just talking to Tony about in a lot of the markets here. Stay right there, friends. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
That if these steps had not been put in place, it could have been 2 million people dead here in the United States?
Yes.
No matter how hard they try to stop us, they can't.
We built the greatest economy the world has ever seen, and we're going to do it again.
Beating back the invisible enemy.
What the federal government did was a phenomenal accomplishment.
Through it all, the world has witnessed the unyielding resolve of our incredible American people.
Promise made. Promise kept.
And I'm fighting for you, and I love doing it with everything that I have. And you know that.
With the grace of God, we will win this war, and we will win this war quickly.
And we will make America great again.
Well, as we join you back here, you hear that incredible setup. That was actually the commercial that was played right when the RNC, the convention, began. That message was put out by the Trump campaign. And there were a couple of interesting points in there. And one of the big things to discuss today is some of the reactions from the governors in regards to COVID. And you hear Governor Newsom there come out and applaud the president's handling of it. And also Governor Cuomo to your largest states, right? New York and California. Comment on the way President Trump handled the pandemic and all, and you know, they you can't deny that once it's out there and they say what they say. Quite fascinating. Also, what's interesting is a Pew Research Center, which talks about the most important issues in the 2020 election. And when you look at crime and the economy and COVID, and interesting, I thought this was quite fascinating where some of these things were. Joining me on the program now to talk about all that is Michael Johns. Michael is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement. He's a former White House speechwriter and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. So these were in this Pew Research Center piece here, Michael, the important issues in the 2020 election. And it was basically, you know, what would incentivize you to vote for this candidate or that candidate or whatever. And this is quite something here, what the Pew Research came out with here. When you start to look at the numbers of the top issues here, the economy is always the case, is top at 79%, most important. Healthcare is next, 68%. Supreme Court appointments, 64%. And what was shocking to me is that all three of those traditional important items for any election were higher than the coronavirus outbreak, which was 62%, and even the violent crime at 59%, which are really, we feel like, the one and two issues. What do you think about this with the economy, healthcare, Supreme Court appointments actually leaping over that?
I think it's telling that perhaps some of the fear regarding coronavirus that has been so profound, really, since particularly over the, you know, since the spring, has perhaps begun to alleviate a little bit, and that maybe also voters are starting to see some limitations in what a federal government can actually do, as it relates to that. I mean, clearly the economy is number one. The good news there for President Trump is 9.5 million jobs created here over the last 3 months. That's really telling. Obviously, many more were lost as a result of this pandemic. Wages, obviously, under President Trump last year were beginning to increase. That's, I think, very, you know, telling. Certainly nothing that Biden will have to talk about. The Supreme Court is intriguing, and I think there's probably a good number of subcategories under that, because I think you have a good number of passionate Americans who want to see a restoration of of the use of original intent and of taking the Constitution for what it means. And, maybe on the other hand, a bunch of radicals who I think would be just as happy tearing it up. That's a big stake, obviously, that we face in this election between those two different contrasting visions.
Well, let's break a few of these down a little bit more. Now, you just mentioned the Supreme Court appointments that are in the Pew Research. And here's the thing. What's interesting to me is 61% of Trump supporters in the Republican side believe that is one of the driving forces of this election. And it's actually a bit higher on the with Biden supporters. That was 66%. So I've suspected all along, in fact, I spoke about this many times on radio, on the programs, that I believe that's one of the really underlying messages that not many are talking about. That is not only the Supreme Court appointments, but all the judges that are being appointed that are in conservative in nature through this administration have been record breaking with Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, and the president. And so those numbers there tell me, and I suspected all along, that the Biden supporters would be more concerned with that, and they are, according to Pew Research. What really is striking to me, this Pew Research is killer. It says so much. I give an example of the coronavirus outbreak, Michael. 39% of Trump supporters, that's a big issue for them. 82% of Biden supporters. I mean, that's crazy. 39 to 82. Same thing with violent crime. 46 on the Biden supporters. Trump is 74. I mean, that kind of tells you right there. On the right, they're concerned more with certain things, and the coronavirus is not one of them, right?
Well, and it breaks down further than that. I mean, if you look at the actual polling on both the use of masks and, you know, the confidence that they have in the use of a mask, and even on the vaccine, I mean, you see that Republicans have a greater degree of trepidation and concern about actually participating in getting a vaccine, you know, when it's rolled out. I guess it's really two very different contrasting visions. On the Supreme Court, I think it's also telling, because why is that now such a high priority issue confronting the American people? One of the reasons is that we have seen, especially in this administration, that, you know, you can, you know, issue great executive orders that have superb policy ends that are consistent with what the American people want, and they still end up being challenged legally and ending up in these courts. And so this has become, you know, not really a body that's interpreting the rule of law as much as it is really affirming or overturning what the rule of law is. It's become increasingly prominent in the development of law. It certainly has lost its way considerably, and I think that's the view that most conservatives would have of it.
You know, you see the category of race and ethnic inequality. 24% of Trump supporters, it's a big concern. 76% of Biden supporters, that's a hell of a disparity there as well. And you can go through multiples of these and see this other one, economic inequality, 28% on the Trump supporters, 65% on Biden supporters. So to me, this Pew Research Survey Center right here, if you take these numbers right here, I think this is sort of the driving force, and it explains so much of what concerns one side to the next. I kind of look at this as a bit, Michael, as a roadmap. Make your campaign, run it around this actual Pew Research and know what the hot buttons are and what they are not. But it's quite telling on the left and the right what is concerning to most Americans, and where one side to the next probably explains a lot why there's so much divide in the country.
Well, also why there's so much money spent by politicians on polling and on the interpretation of the polling. And really, you know, we've gotten to the point where there's two types of governance in this country. One is you sort of look at what the poll is and you try to mold your policies around that and you know, win campaigns that way. The other way, which, you know, in some ways, President Trump, I think, reflected, and I think Reagan also reflected, is that you take where you think the country should be, the policies that you think are most appropriate for it, and you go out and make the case for it, and you try to move those poll numbers. To me, the latter is real leadership.
The other one is healthcare, I find fascinating. 48% of Trump supporters and 84% of Biden supporters. That's big as well. What do you think is going to happen on this with healthcare? Because healthcare costs are out of sight. They're through the roof. People can't afford this. I mean, it's a big part of the family household budget now, way more than it was 20 years ago. It's taking a bigger bite of everybody's checkout, whether you get covered from your employer or not. Nobody seems to have an answer for that. Do we get anywhere in the next administration for the next 4 years?
So obviously the president has taken some leadership in lowering drug costs and readdressing this reimportation issue, and particularly on the drug costs issue, which is where most Americans are getting hit the hardest.
When you hear Governor Cuomo and Governor Newsom say right up front in that interesting commercial spot there they put out there, and they applaud the president's handling of, again, crisis management of the federal government and their approach to helping everybody get up over. And that's when really the country was very fearful and had no knowledge or advanced notice of this pandemic, the way, you know, when really the country was asked to close down for lockdown for 2 weeks and everybody looked at each other like, is this for real? Do you think that that Americans, you know, how much do you think they're going to hold the administration accountable for the coronavirus outbreak? I mean, obviously it comes from the CCP. I mean, everybody should know that. But the Democrats have done their damnedest, it seems, to pin that back on the administration and them being reckless. And, of course, it's fourth down here in this list from Pew.
Yeah.
What do you think?
That is intriguing to see that it's so far low, because I think prior to that, I would have been inclined to say this is going to be issue number one.
Yeah.
It's still well be issue number one, particularly if you include the economic dimension of it, the fact that you know, small businesses especially just confronting such a challenge and being able to sustain themselves in these, you know, so I'm thinking like small bars and restaurants and things like that. Will we recognize this economy when it ultimately reopens? It certainly also I've noticed, and in fact, I've observed in some conversations with some fairly high level people that it's, you know, chains are taking advantage of this. You know, they're moving in with the traditional Walmart plan of, you know, coming in, establishing, you know, it's expanded store numbers, you know, maybe coming in at lower prices and then which they'll ultimately raise. I really worry about the about that component of the economy.
Looking at this whole Pew thing now, when you look at, and just so everybody recognizes here, things like climate change and abortion and economic inequality, these are very low. I mean, they're not even registering in the top group there. You know, while a lot of politicians and people use those as their forward conversation, most Americans say it's just not going to move. You're not going to get their vote based on climate change or abortion or things of that nature, income inequality, obviously the economy, healthcare, Supreme Court appointments. I'm glad to see that in there because that's vitally important. The coronavirus outbreak and then violent crime. Those are really going to be your top five right there as far as important issues in the 2020 election. Now, Michael will be back with me for the second hour again, and we'll dive into all kinds of things there. So let me take a moment here again, and thank you for being with us for our 2 hours here and our journey on Viewpoint. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
What if a new treatment backed by 17,000 scientific articles was proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance? What would you pay for even the smallest dose of this treatment? Well, the good news is you don't have to pay anything, because these are just some of the benefits of a full night of quality sleep. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Until now, most sleep aids haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM Sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
Well, the civil unrest or the peaceful protests that we've all been talking about are absolutely getting out of hand. You're seeing all kinds of things. You're seeing a lot of the images and videos of people just walking to their cars and they're being assaulted and harassed and agitators. And you're seeing where they're actually physically going into restaurants and forcing people to do things. All of this comes under this, this whole narrative about creating a chaos in our cities, I guess, right? I mean, and then parallel to this, let's remind everybody, you have this defund the police, and in some cases, and in other cases, it's abolish the police. So, you know, you've got to question law and order at that point, and you've got to question the safety and security of people. Just, you know, everyday activities now are becoming challenging. Now, a lot of people are thinking this has really become more of an election issue than it should have been, but that is part of the strategy of this election in 2020, was to create this unrest. This is a huge conversation, obviously. It's what we've been talking about here on America Out Loud and across the nation. And I'd like to do that again now in more detail and start with this Kenosha, Wisconsin incident with Jacob Blake here. And I'd like to start and have on for the first time on the program, Bernadette Tapino. And let me tell you about her. She is a chief of police in Sarasota, Florida. But interesting couple of pieces I want to tell you about Bernadette. She began her police career in Baltimore County in 1985. She served 10 years on the SWAT team in Ocean City, and in 2012 became Chief Tapino there in Sarasota. So It's great to have you, Chief DePino, here with me, because you have obviously a different perspective, and you're seeing this stuff, in real time, because you manage a whole force there. So let's bring now to, there's a lot of people jumping to conclusions when they come to these incidents. The latest one is this Jacob Blake here. This is the one in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So what's happening now is that anytime there's an altercation between a black citizen and whoever the cop is, whether it's, I don't even know if it matters anymore, if that the cop is white, black, brown, or yellow, I'm not even sure. But as soon as there's any altercation with a black citizen, it's become a major, major news story. And one of the things I've wondered right out of the gate is when that gentleman was killed that day, that one incident, right? How many other people were shot at or had altercations with police? I mean, as far as white people and Hispanic people and Asian and other types of Americans. I mean, is it safe to say that on any given day, Chief, that there's not just one incident with some criminal? I mean, there's a whole lot of them, but yet the spotlight is on that one. What do you make of that, first of all?
Well, I have to tell you, it concerns me when I see on the national level that people are jumping to conclusions before getting all the facts in these cases. And our police officers engage with citizens every single day, thousands of times across the country, probably hundreds of thousands of times. And those incidents are all very successful. People walk away from the police. They are able to go home safely. And if you look at statistical data, the vast majority of cases that law enforcement are involved with citizens, everybody goes home safely. And I'm seeing that there are, unfortunately, a number of cases where people are not complying with the police and not cooperating with the police that are leading to incidents which, unfortunately, are leading to deaths of people and injuries. And I think it's really troublesome to be Monday morning quarterbacking a case without knowing all of the facts. I'm concerned about my officers going out on the street every single day. They're encountering, you know, challenges from individuals. And there's a lack of civility that I see going on in our society that troubles me. And it's dangerous. And I, as a chief and as a mother of a police officer that's in Baltimore County, it concerns me every day about the safety of our community and the safety of our police officers.
So what do you think is behind the media? I mean, you've got a couple of forces here happening, Chief. You've got the media and you have political people that are using these sort of things, these incidents, for some sort of an agenda. You know, when you talk about what's happening now from what you just described there, it's become acceptable behavior is what's happening now. And so now they're, like you say, they're not listening, first of all, to when the command is coming forward. There's no respect anymore for the cop, the police officer, and the citizen. That respect seems to be gone. And so when you've got the media and the political operatives, spotlighting these problems, what do they benefit for? I mean, what is in your heart with that? Why do they benefit by creating this unrest? And why do they propagate these false pretenses and prejudge, as you say, and throw it out there in the way that they do?
What I can tell you is that because of social media, because of the immediacy of people having access to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, various social media and news outlets, people are able to put out information, and often false information and intentionally false information about a situation, which would get normal citizens upset about seeing something. And the narrative is false. I don't understand why anyone would want to incite people to be angry about an incident without having all the facts.
And I respect what you say there, but it's beyond just social media. I just want to reference something to you here. I'm talking about your major news networks now, and I'm talking about supposedly responsible media people and supposedly political leaders under the whatever that is supposed to be. And I'm not even talking social media, but you're right with what you say. But so why or how do they benefit by this? I mean, what's the motive, the underlying motive to this whole thing? Any ideas?
Well, it's an outstanding question. And I can only say that having experience with the media, on multiple levels beyond what you're talking about, social media, is it sells newspapers, it sells advertisement, it gets attention. And the trouble I find is that I wish the information was factual. And this is right. really nothing new that I've experienced in law enforcement. Many times I've read articles that were written that were about me, and I'm like, that's not how that happened. And I question as to how do people go about reporting legitimate facts and making sure they verify the facts to make sure that yeah. information comes out, as opposed to sensationalized information. We have a high standard of ethics in law enforcement that we have to follow. We have rules, we have laws, and I would think that everyone in the media would have to have those same type of guidelines.
Good luck. Good luck to that. And you know, exactly what you're saying. I mean, we hear you, but there are no ethics anymore. That is long gone. And there seems to be another motive here. All right, let me, specifically about the Kenosha shooting with this Jacob Blake. And by the way, I've heard this man's parents on camera, and they are very well spoken, and they speak about this, what you just said, by the way. They've said the same thing, Chief, and they said, let's get all the facts. Let's not jump to conclusions. I actually seen a video, believe it or not, they did with the Lemon guy there on CNN, and he was edging them on, which is what you and I just talked about, Chief, is that they edge them on to spirit it, and, you know, to get some other rise or motive out of it. And yet, you know, the parents said, let's not do that. But in this particular case, this man, from what I understand, had a criminal background. He was told to stand down. He was explained, you know, to back off. I mean, they're not accepting the orders coming from the police officer as any point of authority. They're challenging the police at every turn is what's happening. And so what happened there, evidently, this guy reached into the car for something. They didn't know. But I guess the other narrative on the other side is 7 shots in the back. I mean, come on. I mean, you could have killed a guy, you paralyzed him. What the hell's the matter with you? Tell me where that fine line is when you have, I mean, I know police officers are making split second decisions, but what goes through the mind and how does that play out in this particular case?
Sure. Well, first of all, anyone that's shot and injured, my heart goes out to them and their families, no matter what the circumstances are. It's a very heartfelt thing when you have your son or your daughter that's injured. I know that personally. And so I'm so sorry for anybody that has to experience that or loses a loved one to gunfire. It's a horrible situation. But if you look at what happened in Wisconsin, the individual was not complying with the police, from what I understand. There may have been warrants out for his arrest. And apparently he either had a weapon or he was reaching inside for a weapon. And being a defensive tactics instructor, and as you said, I was on the SWAT team. I was trained by the FBI in defensive tactics, and liability is what I do in my life. Police officers have to react to the behaviors of individuals, and they use the amount of force that's reasonable in order to be able to defend themselves or someone else.
They have to assume the worst. I'm guessing a police officer has to assume the worst at that moment, that he's got a weapon or he's going for a weapon or something else. So the scales are a little unbalanced there. But you take a look at that other incident which blew this all up in Floyd. Not just real quickly here with Floyd in Minneapolis, when you say reasonable measures, when he put his knee there and held him down, and that became the incident heard around the world, that wouldn't be in relationship to what you just said, right? I mean,
that was not reasonable. That was not reasonable.
We agree on that,
and
right?
We right. totally agree on that. And right. I publicly come out, and I think I know every officer I've talked to, I know every chief across the nation okay. was shocked to see that and immediately said that is not how police officers should treat people. In this case, in Kenosha, though, you have an individual that has already been tased, has already failed to obey what a police officer has asked them to do. I don't know what happened before he went to go reach into the car. Right. But when you go have somebody going to reach into a car while you're in the middle of this whole episode, the officers have to make a decision. Is that person, your assumption is going to be, why are they reaching into that car? Are they reaching in for a weapon? And after you've already tased him and he's refused to comply with you, that's going to be your assumption. What if he would have come out with a gun and shot the police officers? Or if he would have shot and hurt the young people that were inside of the
Which
car?
Happens every day, by the way. That kind of situation, the cops get shot at all the time. But is 7 shots too much, or is that normal?
No, You know, that's what people question. And what people don't understand about when you're shooting, and some people have the belief that you could just shoot somebody in the leg, or why don't you just shoot the gun out of their hand? And that's not realistic. And it's people that have never been put into a fight or flight situation where adrenaline, where your judgment, even if that officer had thought and they saw that this person came out unarmed, in their mind, they've already thought that this person's coming out armed or had a weapon or reaching for a weapon. It takes 1 to 2 seconds for them to actually stop the action before they pull the trigger. So seven shots, some people may think that's a lot. Other people would say, you know what? That officer's probably going to say, I don't know if I shot exactly seven times. And that's not necessarily too many. One is one shot right? Is three shots right? That is too much Monday morning quarterbacking. Okay. And there's experts that can take a look at that to tell you that that's not necessarily an inaccurate number.
That's good. I'm glad you helped set the record straight there, because I really wasn't quite sure. Let me bring into the conversation now Lieutenant Joseph Pangaro. Lieutenant Joe is a retired police lieutenant, director of school security, and as our listeners know, he is the host of Chasing Justice here on America Out Loud. And Lieutenant Joe, now let's we hear Chief DePino there put it out there. Let's bring it right to Kenosha, Wisconsin. What's your view on force with this Jacob Blake? Was that the right amount of force with that situation? And what do you make of it?
Malcolm, first of all, I want to say hi to the chief. And I was listening very closely to everything she said. And any law enforcement officer understands what we're trained to do and how life actually works is different than the public perception. So seven shots, is that too many? My first thought is that once those officers were believed that they were in danger and the people around them were in danger, the officers were trained to shoot until the threat stops. We're not trained to shoot to kill. We're trained to shoot until the threat stops. So seven shots, maybe that guy didn't stop moving inside that car. Maybe he didn't drop. And that's why the officer kept firing until he did. Why didn't he shoot 12 shots? Because at that point, the danger subsided. The guy fell down. He was down. Mm-hmm. So you stop shooting. Very quickly, you can fire seven shots. And that is what we're trained to do. Until the danger is over, you got to protect yourself. Every cop in the world knows. You can go on social media and these different video sites, and you can see tons and tons of videos of people who are resisting, not listening. They run back to their car, they get a weapon, and they're shooting at
people.
It happens all the time. Our officers are not there to take a shot in the face before they're allowed to respond.
Now, Lieutenant Joe, isn't the bigger problem they're just, again, I mentioned the respect, they're just not listening to the police officers anymore. So, I mean, this guy was given commands to stand down and to stay there, and he kept pushing. Isn't that the bigger problem here?
It's a huge problem. And when you look at a state like Virginia, who is now, they're proposing a law that's going to make resisting arrest no longer a felony.
Wow.
They're going to make it a minor charge because people have a right to resist when they don't agree with the cops.
Right.
That is dangerous, not just for the officers. That's dangerous for our entire society.
All right. All right. Very good. Now, let me move from this point here, because one last point about the Kenosha I do want to make is Kamala Harris, the Democrat vice president running there. She came out and spoke about this incident in great detail the other day and kind of spoke about the fact that jumping to conclusions, which is what, Chief, you just said, that they really shouldn't do. And the vice presidential candidate said, I think there should be a thorough investigation. But based on what I've seen, it seems that the officer should be charged. So right away, what's happening is they are charging the, and you know, this is what I think is really becoming unglued now, because Chief, what's happening is they're like the case in Atlanta that happened just recently. They put the officer up for doing his job on with a taser. He was tasered on murder charges. And so this is another situation like this right here, where a political operative comes out and says, you know, yeah, he should be charged. She doesn't even know all the facts yet. Isn't that the problem you were just speaking about a moment ago?
Yes, I have a problem with that, especially she was a prosecutor at one point, and she knows that you need to get all the facts, and you need to be able to establish probable cause, and you need to be able to determine that a crime took place before you jump to that conclusion. I think that's dangerous because it makes people think that maybe the officers did do something wrong without knowing all the facts, and you can't just on the surface. We've seen this historically happen. When I remember an incident in the past, without mentioning any names, that said that the officers were wrong for going up and stopping a subject who was going into his house. a burglar alarm went off. And then immediately an elected official said, that was stupid. They shouldn't have done that. Well, the officer was only doing their job. And the job was, I don't know who you are. I got to make sure that the alarm went off. And it went on to a national narrative. And that continues to this day of people jumping to conclusions. And that puts police officers in a bad position. It puts me in a bad position. I don't know how I'm going to get people to want to become police officers. If you are going to be charged with murder for doing your job or second guessed without people really I really suggest that elected officials and people in the media go through a simunitions training, go through a practical shoot, don't shoot. We've done that before. I've done it here in Sarasota and where I came from in Ocean City, Maryland. We put people through scenarios and we said, okay, you make the decision whether you shoot. Citizens shoot everybody. They don't have any judgment. And our police officers, for the most part, we're not perfect, but for the most part, make the right decision.
Well, nobody can be perfect. You're exactly right. Are you having trouble with getting new recruits? And well, that's one thing. And also officers resigning and retiring. Is that a problem for you there?
Well, I am having officers I see leaving. I'm very grateful and I'm so glad people still want to become police officers. Wow. And they do because of a very purposeful. They want to make a difference. They want to be a significant role in the community and to make things better. But I tell you, with this narrative, I am concerned that in the near future, and I know larger agencies are having a hard time with recruiting and retention of officers.
The rule of law seems to be breaking down. What do you make of all this right now, this shift that's happening in America, and how concerned are you, Joe?
I'm very concerned about it, Malcolm, because at its root, it's become politicized. Everything has become politicized, and one side of our nation sees law enforcement as a legitimate target to rile up their base and who they want to come out. They want to portray what's going on right now as fostering these rioting situations. Protesting is perfectly legitimate when it's just protesting. When it turns into this danger where you are accosted in a restaurant, where people stop you in the middle of the road, where they want to bash the windows out and drag you out of your car. The fact that we're not seeing this immediately put to a stop, this is not protesting.
Right.
You got to see the political leaders have no backbone. It's not the chief and her officers or my officers. They would go out and stop this in a minute. Unfortunately, it's become politicized and these things are ugly. And if you allow them to continue as we have, you embolden people who are.
That's what's happening. Embolden is the right word, Joe, because that's what's happening in a lot of these markets. The criminal content is being emboldened, and you can see them more and more just really getting brazen in their face. Not only are they not listening to the officers, but now in a lot of cases, though, in some of these cities like D.C. with Muriel Bowser, they're the mayor up there, and so many of these cities, Chief Topino, what's happening is the mayors of a lot of these cities have told the police to stand down. They're not allowing them to even protect the citizens. And this is horrible. This isn't just a theory or a talking point. What do you see is behind all? How concerned are you about that? And what do you make of that? I mean, we're seeing something we've never seen before, Chief.
Yeah, I'm really concerned. When I see a really good police chief in Seattle, Washington, resign their position because they feel like they can't do their job, and I'm seeing police chiefs all over the country doing the same exact thing, it concerns me. And I will tell you, though, that the voice that's out there that's negative against the police is such a small number of people. It's just getting the most attention now because the majority of the citizens in our community who I talk to and diverse people in our community, they want and love the police. They support the police. But this narrative that's being spread out makes it seem like it's everybody believes that. And the thing I'm hopeful about is that's just not true, but it makes it very difficult for the police to do their jobs nationwide.
So well said there. You're listening there to the voices of Chief Bernadette Topino. Pleasure to have her on the program for the first time with us, and Lieutenant Joseph Pangaro. All right, so up next, we'll have our second hour of Viewpoint. Got a lot to cover with Michael Johns. You hear, again, Trump's acceptance speech and the RNC. It really was the tale of two conventions. Thank you again for joining me on the mission here. It's time to get involved and get loud.